As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Aura Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
It's all shrouded and circumstantial, but it seems increasingly clear that Ukraine has forces fighting in Sudan. We ask how Ukraine's war at home might be helped by its efforts in Africa.
And I don't think you can truly call yourself a manga fan if you don't know who Toriyama Akira is. Our obituaries editor pays tribute to the father of Dragon Ball Z. But first, in most cases here on The Intelligence, we cover the results of an election after it's actually taken place. But the results of Russia's election, for which voting starts today, are already known. The presidential candidate, known as Vladimir Putin, the country's longest-serving dictator since Joseph Stalin, will be re-elected.
So this is not really an election, because the definition of election is that it offers a choice. And the essence of this election is the absence of choice.
Arkady Ostrovsky is the Russia and Eastern Europe editor for The Economist.
It's almost appropriate for Putin's Russia, where, like in Orwell's 1984, war is peace, ignorance is strength, and freedom is slavery. And so the election is the absence of choice. So this is more of a ritual or an acclamation, which we're going to observe over the next 3 days, where President Putin will get his result and demonstrate to the country, to the elite, and to the world that he still has legitimacy.
What will the election be like? Will people actually turn out to vote in any significant number?
So people will turn up. Some will be forced to come, will be bused to polling stations. Intimidation is already happening. Given a very large proportion of Russian population who are public sector workers, where their bosses tell them to vote, some will come out of habit. Some will be enticed by the Kremlin. It falls on a weekend of sort of the equivalent of Shrove Tuesday, Maslenitsa, which is a sort of a pagan holiday. So, you know, there is a promise of pancakes. There is a promise of lottery tickets. People are getting those SMS messages on their phones saying, come and win a trip to Moscow from other regions, come and win a motorcycle, etc. But in order for this acclamation, in a way, to be effective, it has to be controlled. And what the Kremlin is worried about is that people will heed to Alexei Navalny's advice, and Navalny has called on the country to turn up to protest at the polling station, effectively, against this sham procedure. And the Kremlin's worry is that people will use this opportunity to show their agency, to show that they matter, to show that they exist, to show that they're not just participating in the ritual, but they actually want choice and they want election, they want Vladimir Putin out and this war over. So Navalny called on the country, on the voters, to turn up at a particular time at midday on the last day of the voting to present themselves, to manifest their agency, and therefore breaking this ritual, which is what Navalny has been trying to do for years, to bring elections back to its essence, which is to choose a country they want to live in, to choose the leader, not the usurper in the Kremlin.
Now, speaking of Alexei Navalny, we've spoken at length about him on the show and specifically his death in prison last month. Could the timing of that have had anything to do with this election?
That's a very good question, Ori. It's hard to say with all the certainty, but it looks quite conspicuous in that Navalny was murdered on the 16th of February, exactly a month before this election. And that you could say, yes, well, perhaps it's because there was a talk of exchange of Navalny for one of Putin's assassins. So you can come up with a lot of explanations. But I think there is a historic logic in what happened, because Navalny was not just any opposition leader. He was not just a maverick. Navalny's main goal was the emancipation of people from this deadly empire. And even though Navalny was incarcerated in prison and was given a 19-year prison sentence for extremism, that idea continued to give people hope. And in killing Navalny, basically Putin was saying to the country, abandon this hope. There is no alternative to my rule. There is no alternative to Russia as an empire. There is no alternative to repression. So Navalny could not contest him at the ballot box. But the idea that Navalny projected from prison in his letters, in his court appearance, and in all his demeanor, in his smiles, and in the encouragement he gave people, that was a threat to Putin, because in Putin's world, control has to be absolute. So I think doing this before the elections actually did make sense. And if election is a time when people reflect on what kind of country they live in, then murdering Navalny a month before this procedure was meant to demoralize people.
Arkady, do you think there'll be much of a protest vote?
So in a way, or the protest is already happening. Navalny was buried on the 1st of March after 2 weeks of Putin, the FSB, the Kremlin, refusing to release his body to his family. And at that funeral, some 30,000 people, if not more, turned up. And they queued for hours with flowers, with candles, in this extraordinary outpouring of grief, because I certainly never seen anything like this. You know, he was a politician, but his death was a personal loss to millions of people, because they identified with him and they identified with his ideas. And people turned up showing their faces, looking at the masked police. I think it was an extraordinarily brave moment. People were chanting, no to war, Russia without Putin. And Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalny, and his followers reiterated his advice for people to turn up on the last day of voting on the 17th of March at midday to protest in whatever way they can, whether it's spoiling the ballot paper, whether it's voting for anybody but Putin, whether it's just standing there around polling stations to see the numbers they are in, to be together. Navalny, before he returned to Russia, gave this interview and he was asked what happens if he gets killed. And he said, if they kill me, that means we're exceptionally strong.
Здесь у меня просто очевидная вещь. Ну, не сдавайтесь. Не надо, нельзя сдаваться. Если это произошло, это означает, что мы необыкновенно сильны в этот момент, раз они решили меня убить.
And so, in a way, the importance of this is not so much to change power. The people cannot overthrow Putin with bare arms. But the purpose is to show to the country, to the world, and to themselves that they exist, that they matter, and that nobody could then say, as Putin is desperately trying to say, that he is supported by the absolute majority, and therefore depriving him of this legitimacy, showing that, no, this is a fake, exposing this election for what it is, which is a sham. That's what matters. It matters to themselves, it matters to the country, it matters to the world, to see that, no, Putin doesn't enjoy the support of the real people.
Arkady, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ori.
On the 2nd of March, we published a free bonus episode of Next Year in Moscow, our acclaimed series about the free-thinking Russians who fled after the invasion of Ukraine. Arkady finds out how those who oppose the war are enduring these dark times. Search for Next Year in Moscow or look for the episode Life and Fate in the Intelligence feed.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
For more than a year now, a war has been raging in Sudan between government troops and a rebel paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Over that time, thousands have been killed and millions more have been displaced. But evidence is mounting that the country may also have become a theater for another war, one being fought on another continent, between Russia and Ukraine.
Videos purporting to show Ukrainians in Sudan have been circulating for several months now.
Tom Gardner is The Economist's Horn of Africa correspondent.
Officials in Kyiv and Washington neither confirm nor deny these allegations that Ukrainian special forces are on the ground in parts of Sudan, particularly near the capital, Khartoum. But evidence is mounting that they are in fact there.
So what do you mean by that? What's in the videos that are circulating?
Well, we have some videos which appear to be of kamikaze drones striking buildings in Khartoum, the capital, which experts say are kind of the signature style of Ukrainian drone strikes. At the same time, there are other videos which allegedly show Ukrainian snipers or commandos conducting ground raids on what appear to be buildings in Khartoum. Most recently, though, the Kyiv Post published a video in early February which shows three men kneeling on the ground, topless and blindfolded. One of them is light-skinned. His interrogator, who's also white, addresses him in Russian. The prisoner replies that the group are part of PMC Wagner, adding that about 100 Wagner mercenaries had entered Sudan from the Central African Republic. Now, on the interrogator's arm is an owl insignia, and that's the mark of Ukraine's military intelligence. Open source investigators say that this suggests that a small team of Ukrainian special forces is fighting in Sudan on the side of the National Army, these Sudanese armed forces. Now, some Western diplomats, well-connected ones, as well as sources close to the Sudanese armed forces, do agree as well.
But why? Why would Ukrainian forces be fighting in Africa? They've got plenty to worry about at home, no?
They certainly do, and many diplomats do find it surprising. But I think Ukraine may have several goals, in fact, in Sudan. First, it appears to want to disrupt the flow of gold from facilities reportedly operated by Russia's Wagner mercenary group. Bullion from Sudan, which is Africa's third largest gold producer, is believed to be one way that Russia has mitigated Western financial sanctions. It was revealed, for example, that Russia had paid Iran billions worth of gold bullion to purchase Iranian drones, which were then used in the war in Ukraine.
Okay, so gold is one reason, but you said Ukraine may have several.
Yeah, the other ones are slightly murkier. Ukraine may also have used Sudan as a transit stop to get weapons from third countries. Sudan itself may also have supplied munitions. In September, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, met with Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who's the head of the Sudanese armed forces, to discuss armed groups funded by Russia. Some experts believe they discussed this arms deal. Finally, targeting Russian forces anywhere in the world sends a message. So it's a sort of propaganda coup if they can be shown to be capable of carrying out operations like these. Ukraine ultimately wants to make Russia pay a cost for the war it's conducting in Ukraine by hitting them wherever they can all over the world.
So you say that a lot of this is quite murky and unclear, but are we clear at all on whether this is working on the gold front, the weapons front, the propaganda front?
I think it's too early to say. When it comes to the gold, for example, it will take quite a lot of disruption to this trade for it to have an impact, I think, in terms of Russia's war financing model. It may also require Ukrainian forces extending their footprint beyond Sudan. Remember, gold flowing from other countries in Africa are also significant. Mali, Central African Republic, both places where Wagner is operating and has been operating for some time now, and also has extensive mining and gold mining interests. So I think it's too early to say, but I would imagine Sudan is something of a test case for these kind of operations in the future.
But keeping the focus on Sudan, these being now two sort of partisans on either side of Sudan's civil war, is the sort of involvement of Wagner and Ukraine having any effect on the Sudanese war itself?
It's not entirely clear. The rapid support forces have, in recent months, been rapidly advancing across much of Sudan from their base in the western region of Darfur, across the capital, Khartoum, and even spreading towards the eastern Port Sudan and the Red Sea. So on that measure, no, the Sudanese armed forces are still very much on the back foot, although there have been some recent gains reported in Khartoum in recent days. Ultimately, I don't think the outcome of the civil war in Sudan is going to be determined by a few hundred maximum special forces from Ukraine. But it is certainly concerning that this war seems to be sucking in ever more outsiders. I mean, whether it's Ukraine and Russia or Iran, Egypt, its neighbors, and in particular the United Arab Emirates, all of these countries have now a stake in the outcome of this war, which will make it, in the long run, much harder to resolve.
Tom, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
In his working life, Toriyama Akira had a habit of losing things.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
And as Japan's greatest master of manga, which is the Japanese version of a graphic novel, what he needed more than anything else was a good pen and a good pen holder. When he lost his pen holder, it was a great crisis. He had had the same one, which was sort of pinkish cream colour with black characters on it. Ever since the age of 14, he'd bought it fairly randomly, hadn't even noticed where or especially when. But it had become a faithful companion. He even called it his beloved. He felt he couldn't draw if he hadn't got it. This penholder had been responsible for all his early attempts at manga and very much afterwards. He had used it to enter a competition which was held by a magazine called Weekly Shonen Jump. He didn't win the competition, but his entry drew him to the attention of the magazine. Later on, he published his first real graphic novel called Wonder Island. And then he was asked in 1980 to serialize a character that he had developed called Dr. Slump. Dr. Slump was an inventor, and one of the things he had invented, besides a lot of crazy machines, was a robot girl called Arale. And together they had great adventures going trying out all the doctor's bizarre machines. It only ended because Toriyama Akira had a better idea, which was to base a manga story loosely around an old Chinese novel called Journey to the West, which this time would have as its hero a human boy called Goku. He had a monkey tail and he was extraordinarily strong. He was a martial arts trainee and he met a girl called Bulma who was collecting the magic balls that were being dropped by a terrifying dragon. If you managed to collect all these balls that were being scattered over the earth, you could be granted a single wish by the dragon. And so these two set off on a quest and this was the beginning of Dragon Ball. Goku was particularly striking as the hero. He usually wore an orange kung fu costume And when he leapt up to attack his enemies, of whom he had many, his hair would turn blonde and an enormous electrical charge would flash from his hands. It became something that American boys were very keen to get their hands on.
Vegeta, what does the scouter say about his power level?
It's over 9,000!
What, 9,000? There's no way that could be right!
And that was the first time, really, that manga had made any inroads in the culture of the West. It had been seen before then as just a few books that might be at the back of some video game store, or as something that was so essentially Japanese that you couldn't break out of that culture. But Dragon Ball Z certainly changed the whole outlook for it. And this was a great surprise to its creator. Toriyama Akira had never expected to make any sort of impact with Dr. Slump, because for a start, the heroine was a girl. And he didn't have any hopes particularly for Dragon Ball. He just enjoyed doing the drawings for it. He enjoyed them far more, it seemed, than the ones he'd done for Dr. Slump. It had actually shown him what a hard task it was to draw manga. He was sometimes having to sleep for only about 20 minutes over four nights. He had to meet such crippling deadlines for Shonen Jump. At one point, he even had to enlist his family to ink in the black parts, as he simply didn't have time to do it. Plenty of other projects flowed from that penholder over the years. He designed the characters for Dragon Quest and Chrono Trigger, two video games. And he was kept fairly busy, but began to draw less and less, and people wondered why this was. And the answer seemed to be, or the answer he gave, was that he'd lost his famous penholder. And he had always said he couldn't draw without it, and he felt somewhat lost not to have it. He had tried others, but they simply didn't suit him. And so gradually, people noticed that the drawings were not appearing. He tried to say that it was just an excuse for being lazy, but in fact, he had really needed that companionship with one good tool. And it seemed that with the penholder, he'd also lost his inspiration and something of his will to leap and yell and save the world, as he and the penholder had been doing for all those years.
Anne Rowe on Toriyama Akira, who has died aged 68. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is John Joe Devlin, and our sound engineer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Laranyuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Peter Granitz. And don't forget that subscription sale ends on Sunday. But before then, we'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.